2. The World Order of Baha'u'llah, Further Considerations. March 21st, 1930. To the beloved of the Lord and the handmaids of the merciful throughout the West. Dearly beloved co-workers, amid the reports that have of late reached the Holy Land, most of which witness the triumphant march of the cause, a few seem to betray a certain apprehension regarding the validity of the institutions which stand inseparably associated with the faith of Baha'u'llah. These expressed misgivings appear to be actuated by certain whisperings which have emanated from quarters which are either wholly misformed regarding the fundamentals of the Baha'i revelation, or which deliberately contrive to sow the seeds of dissension in the hearts of the faithful. A blessing in disguise. Viewed in the light of past experience, the inevitable result of such futile attempts, however persistent and malicious they may be, is to contribute to a wider and deeper recognition by believers and unbelievers alike of the distinguishing features of the faith proclaimed by Baha'u'llah. These challenging criticisms, whether or not dictated by malice, cannot but serve to galvanize the souls of its ardent supporters and to consolidate the ranks of its faithful promoters. They will purge the faith from those pernicious elements whose continued association with the believers tends to discredit the fair name of the cause and to tarnish the purity of its spirit. We should welcome, therefore, not only the open attacks which its avowed enemies persistently launch against it, but should also view as a blessing in disguise every storm of mischief with which they who apostatize their faith or claim to be its faithful exponents assail it from time to time. Instead of undermining the faith, such assaults, both from within and from without, reinforce its foundations and excite the intensity of its flame. Designed to becloud its radiance, they proclaim to all the world the exalted character of its precepts, the completeness of its unity, the uniqueness of its position, and the pervasiveness of its influence. I do not feel for one moment that such clamour, mostly attributable to impotent rage against the resistless march of the cause of God, can ever distress the valiant warriors of the faith. For these heroic souls, whether they be contending in America's impregnable stronghold or struggling in the heart of Europe and across the seas as far as the continent of Australasia, have already abundantly demonstrated the tenacity of their faith and the abiding value of their conviction. Distinguishing features of Baha'i World Order. I feel it, however, incumbent upon me, by virtue of the responsibility attached to the guardianship of the faith, to dwell more fully upon the essential character and the distinguishing features of that world order as conceived and proclaimed by Baha'u'llah. I feel impelled at the present stage of the evolution of the Baha'i revelation to state candidly and without any reservation whatever I regard may tend to ensure the preservation of the integrity of the nascent institutions of the faith. I strongly feel the urge to elucidate certain facts which would at once reveal to every fair-minded observer the unique character of that divine civilization, the foundations of which the unerring hand of Baha'u'llah has laid, and the essential elements of which the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá has disclosed. I consider it my duty to warn every beginner in the faith that the promised glories of the sovereignty which the Baha'i teachings foreshadow can be revealed only in the fullness of time, that the implications of the Aqdas and the will of Abdu'l-Bahá as the twin repositories of the constituent elements of that sovereignty are too far-reaching for this generation to grasp and fully appreciate. I cannot refrain from appealing to them who stand identified with the faith to disregard the prevailing notions and the fleeting fashions of the day, and to realize, as never before, that the exploded theories and the tottering institutions of present-day civilization must needs appear in sharp contrast with those God-given institutions which are destined to arise upon their ruin. I pray that they may realize with all their heart and soul the ineffable glory of their calling, the overwhelming responsibility of their mission, and the astounding immensity of their task. For let every earnest upholder of the cause of Baha'u'llah realize that the storms which this struggling faith of God must needs encounter as the process of the disintegration of society advances shall be fiercer than any which it has already experienced. Let him be aware that so soon as the full measure of the stupendous claim of the faith of Baha'u'llah comes to be recognized by those time-honored and powerful strongholds of orthodoxy, whose deliberate aim is to maintain their stranglehold over the thoughts and consciences of men, this infant faith will have to contend with enemies more powerful and more insidious than the cruelest torture-mongers and the most fanatical clerics who have afflicted it in the past. What foes may not, in the course of the convulsions that shall seize a dying civilization, be brought into existence, who will reinforce the indignities which have already been heaped upon it? The onslaught of all peoples and kindreds. We have only to refer to the warnings uttered by Abdu'l-Bahá in order to realize the extent and character of the forces that are destined to contest with God's holy faith. In the darkest moments of his life, under Abdul-Hamid's regime, when he stood ready to be deported to the most inhospitable regions of northern Africa, and at a time when the auspicious light of the Baha'i revelation had only begun to break upon the West, he, in his parting message to the cousin of the Bab, uttered these prophetic and ominous words: "How great, how very great is the cause! How very fierce the onslaught of all the peoples and kindreds of the earth! Ere long shall the clamour of the multitude throughout Africa, throughout America, the cry of the European and of the Turk, the groaning of India and China be heard from far and near. One and all, they shall arise with all their power to resist his cause. Then shall the knights of the Lord, assisted by his grace from on high, strengthened by faith, aided by the power of understanding, and reinforced by the legions of the covenant, arise and make manifest the truth of the verse: Behold the confusion that hath befallen the tribes of the defeated." Stupendous as is the struggle which his words foreshadow, they also testify to the complete victory which the upholders of the greatest name are destined eventually to achieve. Peoples, nations, adherents of diverse faiths will jointly and successively arise to shatter its unity, to sap its force, and to degrade its holy name. They will assail not only the spirit which it inculcates, but the administration which is the channel, the instrument, the embodiment of that spirit. For as the authority with which Baha'u'llah has invested the future Baha'i Commonwealth becomes more and more apparent, the fiercer shall be the challenge which from every quarter will be thrown at the verities it enshrines. Difference between Baha'i faith and ecclesiastical organizations. It behooves us, dear friends, to endeavour not only to familiarise ourselves with the essential features of this supreme handiwork of Baha'u'llah, but also to grasp the fundamental difference existing between this world-embracing, divinely appointed order and the chief ecclesiastical organisations of the world, whether they pertain to the Church of Christ or to the ordinances of the Mohammedan dispensation. For those whose priceless privilege it is to guard over, administer the affairs, and advance the interests of these Baha'i institutions, will have sooner or later to face this searching question: where and how does this order established by Baha'u'llah, which to outward seeming is but a replica of the institutions established in Christianity and Islam, differ from them? Are not the twin institutions of the House of Justice and of the Guardianship, the institution of the Hands of the Cause of God, the institution of the National and Local Assemblies, the institution of the Mashr al-Askar, but different names for the institutions of the Papacy and the Caliphate, with all their attending ecclesiastical orders which the Christians and Muslims uphold and advocate? What can possibly be the agency that can safeguard these Baha'i institutions, so strikingly resemblant in some of their features to those which have been reared by the fathers of the Church and the Apostles of Muhammad, from witnessing the deterioration in character, the breach of unity, and the extinction of influence which have befallen all organized religious hierarchies? Why should they not eventually suffer the self-same fate that has overtaken the institutions which the successors of Christ and Muhammad have reared? Upon the answer given to these challenging questions will in a great measure depend the success of the efforts which believers in every land are now exerting for the establishment of God's kingdom upon earth. Few will fail to recognize that the spirit breathed by Baha'u'llah upon the world, and which is manifesting itself with varying degrees of intensity through the efforts consciously displayed by his avowed supporters and indirectly through certain humanitarian organizations, can never permeate and exercise an abiding influence upon mankind unless and until it incarnates itself in a visible order which would bear his name, wholly identify itself with his principles, and function in conformity with his laws. That Baha'u'llah in his Book of Aqdas, and later Abdu'l-Bahá in his will, a document which confirms, supplements, and correlates the provisions of the Aqdas, have set forth in their entirety those essential elements for the constitution of the world Baha'i Commonwealth, no one who has read them will deny. According to these divinely ordained administrative principles, the dispensation of Baha'u'llah, the ark of human salvation, must needs be modelled. From them all future blessings must flow, and upon them its inviolable authority must ultimately rest. For Baha'u'llah, we should readily recognise, has not only imbued mankind with a new and regenerating spirit, he has not merely enunciated certain universal principles or propounded a particular philosophy, however potent, sound, and universal these may be. In addition to these, he, as well as Abdu'l-Bahá after him, has, unlike the dispensations of the past, clearly and specifically laid down a set of laws, established definite institutions, and provided for the essentials of a divine economy. These are destined to be a pattern for future society, a supreme instrument for the establishment of the Most Great Peace, and the one agency for the unification of the world and the proclamation of the reign of righteousness and justice upon the earth. Not only have they revealed all the directions required for the practical realization of those ideals which the prophets of God have visualized, and which from time immemorial have inflamed the imagination of seers and poets in every age, they have also, in unequivocal and emphatic language, appointed those twin institutions of the House of Justice and of the Guardianship as their chosen successors, destined to apply the principles, promulgate the laws, protect the institutions, adapt loyally and intelligently the faith to the requirements of progressive society, and consummate the incorruptible inheritance which the founders of the faith have bequeathed to the world. Should we look back upon the past, were we to search out the Gospel and the Quran, we will readily recognize that neither the Christian nor the Islamic dispensations can offer a parallel either to the system of divine economy so thoroughly established by Baha'u'llah, or to the safeguards which he has provided for its preservation and advancement. Therein, I am profoundly convinced, lies the answer to those questions to which I have already referred. None, I feel, will question the fact that the fundamental reason why the unity of the Church of Christ was irretrievably shattered, and its influence was, in the course of time, undermined, was that the edifice which the fathers of the church reared after the passing of his first apostle was an edifice that rested in no wise upon the explicit directions of Christ himself. The authority and features of their administration were wholly inferred and indirectly derived, with more or less justification, from certain vague and fragmentary references which they found scattered amongst his utterances as recorded in the Gospel. Not one of the sacraments of the Church, not one of the rites and ceremonies which the Christian fathers have elaborately devised and ostentatiously observed, not one of the elements of the severe discipline they rigorously imposed upon the primitive Christians, none of these reposed on the direct authority of Christ or emanated from his specific utterances. Not one of these did Christ conceive. None did he specifically invest with sufficient authority to either interpret his word or to add to what he had not specifically enjoined. For this reason, in later generations, voices were raised in protest against the self-appointed authority, which arrogated to itself privileges and powers which did not emanate from the clear text of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, and which constituted a grave departure from the spirit which that Gospel did inculcate. They argued with force and justification that the canons promulgated by the councils of the Church were not divinely appointed laws, but were merely human devices which did not even rest upon the actual utterances of Jesus. Their contention centered around the fact that the vague and inconclusive words addressed by Christ to Peter, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church," could never justify the extreme measures, the elaborate ceremonials, the fettering creeds and dogmas with which his successors have gradually burdened and obscured his faith. Had it been possible for the Church Fathers, whose unwarranted authority was thus fiercely assailed from every side, to refute the denunciations heaped upon them by quoting specific utterances of Christ regarding the future administration of his church, or the nature of the authority of his successors, they would surely have been capable of quenching the flame of controversy and preserving the unity of Christendom. The gospel, however, the only repository of the utterances of Christ, afforded no such shelter to these harassed leaders of the church, who found themselves helpless in the face of the pitiless onslaught of their enemy, and who eventually had to submit to the forces of schism which invaded their ranks. In the Mohammedan revelation, however, although his faith, as compared with that of Christ, was, so far as the administration of his dispensation is concerned, more complete and more specific in its provisions, yet in the matter of succession, it gave no written, no binding and conclusive instructions to those whose missions was to propagate his cause. For the text of the Quran, the ordinances of which regarding prayer, fasting, marriage, divorce, inheritance, pilgrimage, and the like, have after the revolution of 1300 years remained intact and operative, gives no definite guidance regarding the law of succession, the source of all the dissensions, the controversies and schisms which have dismembered and discredited Islam. Not so with the revelation of Baha'u'llah. Unlike the dispensation of Christ, unlike the dispensation of Muhammad, unlike all the dispensations of the past, the apostles of Baha'u'llah in every land, wherever they labour and toil, have before them in clear, in unequivocal and emphatic language all the laws, the regulations, the principles, the institutions, the guidance they require for the prosecution and consummation of their task. Both in the administrative provisions of the Baha'i dispensation and in the matter of succession, as embodied in the twin institutions of the House of Justice and of the Guardianship, the followers of Baha'u'llah can summon to their aid such irrefutable evidences of divine guidance that none can resist, that none can belittle or ignore. Therein lies the distinguishing feature of the Baha'i revelation. Therein lies the strength of the unity of the faith, of the validity of a revelation that claims not to destroy or belittle previous revelations, but to connect, unify, and fulfill them. This is the reason why Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá have both revealed and even insisted upon certain details in connection with the divine economy which they have bequeathed to us, their followers. This is why such an emphasis has been placed in their will and testament upon the powers and prerogatives of the ministers of their faith. For nothing short of the explicit directions of their book and the surprisingly emphatic language with which they have clothed the provisions of their will could possibly safeguard the faith for which they have both so gloriously laboured all their lives. Nothing short of this could protect it from the heresies and calumnies with which denominations, peoples, and governments have endeavoured and will, with increasing vigour, endeavour to assail it in the future. We should also bear in mind that the distinguishing character of the Baha'i revelation does not solely consist in the completeness and unquestionable validity of the dispensation, which the teachings of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá have established. Its excellence lies also in the fact that those elements which in past dispensations have without the least authority from their founders been a source of corruption and of incalculable harm to the faith of God, have been strictly excluded by the clear text of Baha'u'llah's writings. Those unwarranted practices in connection with the sacrament of baptism, of communion, of confession of sins, of asceticism, of priestly domination, of elaborate ceremonials, of holy war, and of polygamy, have one and all been rigidly suppressed by the pen of Baha'u'llah, whilst the rigidity and rigour of certain observances, such as fasting, which are necessary to the devotional life of the individual, have been considerably abated. A living organism. It should also be borne in mind that the machinery of the cause has been so fashioned that whatever is deemed necessary to incorporate into it in order to keep it in the forefront of all progressive movements can, according to the provisions made by Baha'u'llah, be safely embodied therein. To this testify the words of Baha'u'llah, as recorded in the eighth leaf of the Exalted Paradise. It is incumbent upon the trustees of the House of Justice to take counsel together regarding those things which have not outwardly been revealed in the book, and to enforce that which is agreeable to them. God will verily inspire them with whatsoever he willeth, and he verily is the provider, the omniscient. Not only has the House of Justice been invested by Baha'u'llah with the authority to legislate whatsoever has not been explicitly and outwardly recorded in his holy writ, upon it has also been conferred, by the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá, the right and power to abrogate, according to the changes and requirements of the time, whatever has been already enacted and enforced by a preceding House of Justice. In this connection, he revealed the following in his will. And inasmuch as the House of Justice hath power to enact laws that are not expressly recorded in the book and bear upon daily transactions, so also it hath power to repeal the same. Thus, for example, the House of Justice enacteth today a certain law and enforceth it, and 100 years hence, circumstances having profoundly changed and the conditions having altered, another House of Justice will then have power, according to the exigencies of the time, to alter that law. This it can do because that law formeth no part of the divine explicit text. The House of Justice is both the initiator and the abrogator of its own laws. Such is the immutability of his revealed word. Such is the elasticity which characterizes the functions of his appointed ministers. The first preserves the identity of his faith and guards the integrity of his law. The second enables it, even as a living organism, to expand and adapt itself to the needs and requirements of an ever-changing society. Dear friends, feeble though our faith may now appear in the eyes of men, who either denounce it as an offshoot of Islam or contemptuously ignore it as one more of those obscure sects that abound in the West, this priceless gem of divine revelation, now still in its embryonic state, shall evolve within the shell of his law and shall forge ahead, undivided and unimpaired, till it embraces the whole of mankind. Only those who have already recognized the supreme station of Baha'u'llah, only those whose hearts have been touched by his love and have become familiar with the potency of his spirit can adequately appreciate the value of this divine economy, his inestimable gift to mankind. Leaders of religion, exponents of political theories, governors of human institutions who at present are witnessing with perplexity and dismay the bankruptcy of their ideas and the disintegration of their handiwork, would do well to turn their gaze to the revelation of Baha'u'llah and to meditate upon the world order, which, lying enshrined in his teachings, is slowly and imperceptibly rising amid the welter and chaos of present-day civilization. They need have no doubt or anxiety regarding the nature, the origin, or validity of the institutions which the adherents of the faith are building up throughout the world. For these lie embedded in the teachings themselves, unadulterated and unobscured by unwarrantable interferences or unauthorized interpretations of his word. How pressing and sacred the responsibility that now weighs upon those who are already acquainted with these teachings. How glorious the task of those who are called upon to vindicate their truth and demonstrate their practicability to an unbelieving world. Nothing short of an immovable conviction in their divine origin and their uniqueness in the annals of religion. Nothing short of an unwavering purpose to execute and apply them to the administrative machinery of the cause can be sufficient to establish their reality and ensure their success. How vast is the revelation of Baha'u'llah! How great the magnitude of his blessings showered upon humanity in this day! And yet, how poor, how inadequate our conception of their significance and glory! This generation stands too close to so colossal a revelation to appreciate in their full measure the infinite possibilities of his faith, the unprecedented character of his cause, and the mysterious dispensations of his providence. In the Iqan, Baha'u'llah, wishing to emphasize the transcendent character of this new day of God, reinforces the strength of his argument by his reference to the text of a correct and authorized tradition, which reveals the following. Knowledge is 27 letters. All that the prophets have revealed are 2 letters thereof. No man thus far hath known more than these 2 letters. But when the Qa'im shall arise, he will cause the remaining 25 letters to be made manifest. And then immediately follow these confirming and illuminating words of Baha'u'llah. Consider, he hath declared knowledge to consist of 27 letters and regarded all the prophets from Adam even unto Muhammad, the seal, as expounders of only 2 letters thereof. He also saith that the Qa'im will reveal all the remaining 25 letters. Behold, from this utterance, how great and lofty is his station. His rank excelleth that of all the prophets, and his revelation transcendeth the comprehension and understanding of all their chosen ones. A revelation of which the prophets of God, his saints and chosen ones, have either not been informed, or which in pursuance of God's inscrutable decree they have not disclosed, such a revelation these vile and villainous people have sought to measure with their own deficient minds, their own deficient learning and understanding. In another passage of the same book, Baha'u'llah, referring to the transformation effected by every revelation in the ways, thoughts, and manners of the people, reveals these words: "Is not the object of every revelation to effect a transformation in the whole character of mankind, a transformation that shall manifest itself both outwardly and inwardly, that shall affect both its inner life and external conditions? For if the character of mankind be not changed, the futility of God's universal manifestations would be apparent." Did not Christ himself, addressing his disciples, utter these words: "I have yet many things to say unto you, but ye cannot bear them now. Howbeit, when he, the Spirit of truth, is come, he will guide you into all truth." From the text of this recognized tradition, as well as from the words of Christ as attested by the Gospel, every unprejudiced observer will readily apprehend the magnitude of the faith which Baha'u'llah has revealed, and recognize the staggering weight of the claim he has advanced. No wonder if Abdu'l-Bahá has portrayed in such lurid colors the fierceness of the agitation that shall center in the days to come round the nascent institutions of the faith. We can now but faintly discern the beginnings of that turmoil, which the rise and ascendancy of the cause of God is destined to cast in the world. The greatest drama of the world's spiritual history. Whether in the ferocious and insidious campaign of repression and cruelty which the rulers of Russia have launched against the upholders of the faith under their rule, whether in the unyielding animosity with which the Shiites of Islam are trampling upon the sacred rights of the adherents of the cause in connection with Baha'u'llah's house in Baghdad, whether in the impotent rage which has impelled the ecclesiastical leaders of the Sunnite sect of Islam to expel our Egyptian brethren from their midst, in all of these we can perceive the manifestations of the relentless hate which peoples, religions, and governments entertain for so pure, so innocent, so glorious a faith. Ours is the duty to ponder these things in our heart, to strive to widen our vision and to deepen our comprehension of this cause, and to arise resolutely and unreservedly to play our part, however small, in this greatest drama of the world's spiritual history. Your brother and co-worker, Shoghi. Haifa, Palestine, March 21, 1930.